So the photon polarization is an example of a natural property that behaves like a quantum bit. The mathematics of the physics of polarization of photons works like the abstract math of a quantum bit. And when you're building a quantum computer, you want quantum bits that behave that way mathematically and physically, but are easy to manufacture and easy to control, and easy to set up these dependencies between the quantum bits to do the entanglement.
Welcome to the Tangible Computing Podcast. My name is Andrew Rutgers, co-host.
And I'm Gareth Thomas.
The Tangible Computing Podcast is about where computing meets the real world. From the fast and complex, like controlling an engine, to imaging a patient or scheduling an airline. We want to trigger your curiosity by talking to the people behind the scenes of making the modern world happen, deepening your understanding of where computation plays a role in our everyday lives and motivating you to help engineer a better world.
This podcast is powered by Version Bay, a consulting company that offers experienced consultants to professionalize your MATLAB, Simulink, and Python projects, minimizing the risk and quantifying the value in migrating to newer software environments.
And now, let's find out how software drives the world. Today, we're interviewing Paul Kassebaum from IBM, and he is a partnership developer in quantum computing. So his role is to help customers find wonderful new things they can do with quantum computing, and today we're going to talk about some of what those things are. So first off, Paul, to get started, can you tell us a fun fact about yourself?
Oh, yeah, sure. Fun fact is, for a long time, I used to think I was going to become an artist, and I would just draw and draw and draw. And people are surprised to learn that the kid who was always drawing and making art went off to study science.
but I think you've managed to find an amusing intersection of those, because we talked about that a little bit at one of the earlier conversations.
Hmm. My interest in art hasn't waned, just added an interest in physics. And I look for ways to combine those things. And sometimes my day job lets me dovetail them. My last work with a colleague of mine who is an artist by trade, we've been working together to create quantum computing art using quantum computers as a medium to generate art. And we were working with the New School in New York City to hold a design jam for a week to teach design and art students enough about quantum computing to start using it as like a new paintbrush. And we had over 10 teams generate extremely unique artworks that I got to judge, had the privilege to see.
So Paul, the way that you say that, you make it sound like it's super easy, super trivial. So I'm sure many people have heard the word quantum computing and they probably have a very vague definition of it. Can you maybe elaborate exactly, how do you describe what quantum computing is for artists?
Yeah, well, I wanted to make it tangible. I actually thought of it, I use that word a lot. So I like your podcast's title a lot. But to make quantum computing tangible for artists, I used a piece of material that a physics professor taught me. I hadn't really gotten exposed to myself until grad school. And he was surprised to learn that as he showed it to me for the first time, which was using what are called polarizing films, things that are materials that you typically have on your polarized sunglasses. And showed me how you can actually see a quantum effect, a lot of different quantum effects, just with a couple of sheets of this polarizing film, including phenomena like what does it mean for something, some property to be quantized? In this case, you're looking at a property of photons called the polarization, and it has a certain directionality to it, this property. And you might think of a compass needle having a certain directionality analogously. But whereas a compass needle can have any arbitrary angle as you spin it around relative to the Earth's magnetic field, the polarization of photons as it goes through these films can only ever take on one of two discrete directions, parallel or perpendicular to the molecule chains that make up the plastic film, and nothing in between. Nature basically says, No, you don't. The polarization must choose one of these two, nothing in between. And that's one of the more direct quantum phenomena you can make sense of or see evidence of with these ubiquitous thin films.
So maybe to kind of translate that in maybe into my layman's terms. So are you saying that kind of like when you buy polarized sunglasses, the idea is you kind of only letting what perpendicular or parallel parts of the light go through, and that's making it better or easier on your eyes? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. So if you're looking at randomly polarized light, like from an incandescent light bulb or the sun rays coming directly towards you, don't stare at the sun, but you'll roughly cut the brightness of the randomly polarized light in half. Roughly half of them will be quantized to be parallel, and roughly half will be quantized to be perpendicular and not get through.
And I think you kind of shared in the pre-show that you had an interesting case of what happens when you put two polarized sheets next to each other. Can you kind of correlate that with what is actually quantum computing and explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so when you're making something into a computing medium, you want it to have some property that is able to be controlled. You can control the permutations of what value that property has, and you want to be able to make sure that that property is distinguishable. And with a single film, you can distinguish between photons with polarization that are either parallel or orthogonal to the molecular chain in the film. And you can do information science with that property by thinking of those two values of the polarization as your zero and your one. Once you start playing with a couple of more sheets of this film, so if you have two sheets of the film, you can have light go through one of them and hold the next piece of film perpendicular to the first. And all of the light that got through the first film will now get blocked by the second one. And you'll think, oh, okay, I get it. There's this sort of perpendicularness. The perpendicularness of the molecule chain's directions have something to do with perpendicularness of what's allowed to get through one and the other. Something a little weird happens when you take a third sheet and sandwich it between those two. And you say, okay, whatever got through the first one, now, let's say it's parallel to the first one. Now it has to choose, the quantization phenomena says it must, whatever gets through the second sandwiched film, that's now, let's say, a 45 degree angle. The only possible values are parallel or orthogonal to this thing. If you're thinking in a classical way, you'd think, well, since it got through the first film, let's say it's vertical, the film. All of the photons that got through have a vertical polarization property. It's not parallel or orthogonal to the 45 degree film. But nature says, too bad, you must choose. And what ends up happening is the choice is made probabilistically, randomly, but predictably random. You can predict the probability distributions. But for each individual photon, you don't know which of the two choices it's going to make. And then now that it's gone through some of that went through the 45 degree film, the physics and the math would work out to be a 50-50 chance that it'll go through that second film. Now it will, now remember the second film is a sandwich between the two perpendicular films. This third film is now 45 degrees relative to that sandwiched diagonal film, right? And that same sort of quantization problem happens again. It must choose to be, are you parallel or are you orthogonal to this third film? But wait, it got through the diagonal film, so it should be neither. Too bad, you must choose. And it will choose it probabilistically, again, 50-50. And the end result is that if you have these three films, you'll have more light going through the three films than you would with the original two perpendicular. The original two perpendicular ones, you have no light going through. Then you slip this third sandwich between them and suddenly more light gets through. And what this is showing is that you can have, if you try to distinguish between two different pairs of orthogonal directions, say up, down, left, right, vertical horizontal, and you try to distinguish it between another orthogonal pair of two diagonal directions, say up and to the right and down and to the right, that you can't distinguish between these two pairs. And this is where quantum information starts differing from classical information. With classical information, if you have two properties of light, say its color and its polarization, right? We'll take those two properties. And you say, is it red or is it not red? Is one sort of zero and one labeling of the color property. And is it horizontal or vertical? Another zero or one labeling of the polarization property. Then you can create a two-bit system by composing those two properties, right? Thinking of them independently. But so you've got two properties that act like information, the color property and the polarization property, and you can build them together to build a bigger, in this case, two-bit information system. With quantum information, if you can have these properties that are not distinguishable from each other, that on their own work like information, but when you try to combine them together, they don't work like a composite information system. And so it's set of three films is actually showing you this, because when you have the two orthogonal ones, they're distinguishable from each other. You can tell one from the other. And then suddenly more light starts slipping through all three of the filters. And now you can't really distinguish the horizontal vertical pair versus this new diagonal element. And it turns out there are weird counterintuitive implications of that. The fact that two properties that work like classical information on their own can't be combined to build a bigger system that works as a composite information system. We take that for granted, that you can do that composition. But when you can't do that composition, there are all sorts of provable but counterintuitive implications. And the properties that a lot of people will hear about or read about in their first article about quantum computing will call out things like superposition or entanglement. And a couple of very interesting scientists have shown that failure to be able to compose these things into a bigger information system implies superposition and implies entanglement. And it's sort of getting at these weird quantum phenomena from first principles of thinking about information.
So I like the way that you kind of describe quantum computing in a very natural way with the polarized sunglasses. I would like to maybe dive a little bit deeper in some of these applications. So I know you work at IBM, and I'm sure your day job is finding cool commercial business viable applications, but you started the podcast talking about your passion of art. Can you tell us a little bit more of how did you get artists to actually leverage this in some shape or form? So I'm curious to see how or what an artist would do with what you just described.
Yeah. So what I honed in on in my talk to the group of students, about 100 students, all in art and design, was I said, after I showed them that tangible example, and I showed them some tangible examples of classical information, like this is, I pull a card from the top of a deck, and this, it turns out to be the Queen of Hearts, but it could have been that I picked out any one of the other 51 cards. That's a counterfactual, like this happens, but you know that all these other things could have happened. And then that's different from, I picked the Queen of Hearts out of a deck of four cards, and all four of the cards are the different types of queens. And so I picked the Queen of Hearts, but it could have been one of the other three queens. And that's another counterfactual. So there's two situations are instantiating different sorts of classical information. Anyway, so I showed them some tangible classical and tangible quantum information examples. And then I honed them in on 9 unique properties of quantum information media. There are some things in common between classical and quantum information media, but there are 9 unique things about quantum that all come from that failure to form a bigger composed information media from at least two properties. And some of the things that I had them focus on was the indistinguishability of two properties. I had them focus on quantization. I had them focus on the fact that you can have what are sometimes called non-sharp states. So an example to explain what that phrase means, a sharp or a non-sharp state. When you send that photon through, say, a vertically aligned filter, comes out the other side, it is sharp with respect to vertical or horizontal films. And you can see that by putting a whole series, instead of just after it goes through the first vertical filter, you can put it through as many more vertical filters as you want, and it'll always get through. Nothing random about that. Or you can, after it goes through the first vertical filter, you can put it through one of horizontal filters, and it will definitely get blocked. And then as many horizontal as you want, and it, you know, it'll not get it. If it got blocked the first time, nothing else will get through. And so there's this behavior that's not random with respect to these two directions of forcing the quantization or observation or measurement, right? So we say after it went through that first vertical filter, the polarization is sharp with respect to vertical horizontal films, but it is not sharp with respect to a diagonal film, and it will behave whether it gets through or not, which direction it will be quantized along will behave randomly. So we say the system is sharp or not sharp with respect to some way we're going to measure it. And in this example, if you're used to linear algebra or vector spaces, you can think of a sharp or non-sharp basis in which you're going to measure it. So there's one special basis in which it's sharp, and all the other bases that you can get from rotating the first pair where it's not sharp. So I had a lot of the students focused on that property of sharp or unsharp. And so when you think about quantum computing, a lot of times you hear people say a quantum bit, or qubit for short, can be more than just zero or one. It can be a superposition of zero and one. With the photon example, what you would say is the photon can be more than just sharp in the vertical or horizontal directions of measuring it. It can also be unsharp in any other pair of orthogonal directions that are derived by rotating the vertical horizontal pair of bases.
So just to make sure I understand, so does that mean that if I was to put an image through this mechanism, that I could have hidden images superposed on top of each other? A bit like those images where you look at on the left, it's one image, and then on the right, it's another one?
That reminds me of one of the art projects that came out of this design jam, actually. Before I go there, though, there's one common misunderstanding here, which you might be skating really close to, which is if a single measurement, a single observation, there's no way to tell whether the quantum system was or was not sharp before you measured it. And that translates to there's no way to observe all of those hidden parts of your image. You only see some piece of that image. If you try to store information in these unsharp parts of the state, those wouldn't be accessible to you with a single observation. You might be able to capture it through many, many observations and collecting statistics, though.
See how a traditional imaging sensor works, that otherwise you get shot noise of kind of individual photon hits, but then as you collect a large amount of it, then you can start to resolve gradients and different intensities of different pixels. So there, the quantum system will have to be measured many times in order to get you the probability outcome of this unsharp state.
Yes, exactly. And this reminds me of a project that one of the student groups did, which is they created, first they set up a really nice history of the art form that they were experimenting with. And they talked about artists who were taking long exposures of films back when film was a new technology. They would create a single image, a single photograph by taking a long exposure of a whole entire film. Yeah. And so what they did was they took a film of some interesting compositions, and then they created a superposition of the entire film on the computer. Now, today's quantum computers aren't really big enough to do that, so they made some shortcuts, but we told them to stretch the imagination. You know, imagine you had a fully capable, bigger, you know, fully mature quantum computer rather than the nascent technology today. So they created a superposition of the entire video, and then for each pixel in the screen, they measured that superposition pixel by pixel, and each pixel with some probability would be chosen from one of the frames of the video in the superposition and creating an overall composition. They had a still scene and they had some like a subject in the scene that was non-stationary. So it wasn't totally garbled visual nonsense. You could still make sense of the part of the scene that was still, and you could see this sort of sampling of what was moving in the scene. So it's very similar to what you were thinking about, Gareth.
I suppose that's also because if I think about film composition, there's a handful of things that you're going to try and do the same. I mean, we're talking right now on Zoom, and at the moment it's all, you know, all three of us are our faces in the center of the screen. You know, there's shoulders below it, and we've got two eyes, all this kind of thing. And so if we were to layer together the three of our images, because there's that consistency in the composition, we would still get some kind of a meaningful image you'd be able to pick something out of. And here you're enabling that through kind of using quantum computing to help to build that aggregate.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that my artist colleague, Russ Hoffman, actually really insisted upon for the students was they had to use real quantum computers. They couldn't use classical simulations of them. So because we wanted to be able to say, yes, you might be in some of these projects, you might be able to get the same answer with a random number generator. But this actually went through a real quantum computer. Which means these students intentionally created superpositions, real life superpositions and entanglements on the quantum hardware to generate these compositions, or at least elements of them. And when I first started playing with quantum computers, as I joined IBM 3 years ago, I got giddy. I still do from time to time. I get giddy when I think about running stuff on the real quantum hardware and thinking like, yeah, whoa, I'm actually creating a superposition. I'm actually creating an entanglement. This is wild, like a real thing. Those polarization films let you play with the concept of non-sharp states, otherwise usually called superposition. The one thing you can't play with those, though, is entanglement. And so that's the one that I still get giddy about on the real quantum computers. And entanglement is used in pretty much all of the meaningful quantum algorithms these days. So unless you're just starting to learn quantum computing and playing with the most basic of quantum logic gates, you're probably setting up entanglements.
And this is where you have multiple quantum bits that are entangled with each other. So the state of one has an impact on the state of the other without necessarily that being very, very explicitly obvious. And then it also tends to be in this sort of non-sharp or probabilistic way, which I understand is what makes this very interesting for things like cryptography, because you can run through several different permutations, or you can in effect try, you know, many different, for instance, security keys in parallel, simultaneously with the same set of bits at speeds that would be absolutely, you know, mind-blowing to try and do with traditional, you know, digital logic computer with just ones and zeros.
Yeah, it's not exactly analogous to parallel computing. It has some of the same properties of it. So people in the industry will talk about quantum parallelism to try to make a distinction with classical computing parallelism. It has the danger of making it easy to confuse the two, or to think one is just as powerful as the other. For a sufficiently powerful supercomputer, classical parallel computing is actually more powerful than quantum parallelism.
If it's a case that you want all of the answers to your parallel computing, so like your graphics card, then you're running many things in parallel and you want to see all of them, as opposed to the cryptography case where you're really only interested in one answer, what the secret key happens to be. And so while you have all this parallelism, when you observe it and it collapses back to the single answer, that's very different from the classical one where you have an enormous array of outputs. Am I framing that mentally reasonably?
Yeah, and one of the other intuitive ways I've come to think about it is quantum computing is really good at solving problems that have some sort of global characteristic to them. And so that different parts of the superpositions that you're setting up can, in a sense, in a real sense, cancel each other out or reinforce each other through a sort of mathematically very similar to classical interference, like interference of sound waves. But in this case, you're interfering waves that are understood with complex numbers. One of the classic examples of that you experience early on in like a intro textbook to quantum computing is trying to determine whether a function given any input, whether that function will return something that is all zeros or all ones, or if it returns something that has, let me make sure I'm saying this correctly. It's either all zeros or all ones, or just as many zeros as there are ones in the output, given any input, right? Mm-hmm. And so in other words, is it the case that I can, if I put any input into this function, I'm always going to get all zeros in my bit string at the end? And classically, you may have to check if you have n bits in your output string. Classically, you might have to check all n to make sure they really are all zero, right? If there's, so it's, or n divided by two, I should say, right? Check half of the output bits. So far, they're all zero. What's the next one, n over two plus one, going to be? Is that also zero or not? And with quantum computers, there's an algorithm that can, in a sense, feel out that entire solution through cancellations and through constructive and destructive interference of the quantum bits, and sort of feel out the global nature of that output string and determine whether its global characteristic is a constant function, all zeros or all ones at the output, or a balanced function, just as many zeros as there are ones, right? So there's this global characteristic it can feel out and solve for efficiently.
So we've been talking a lot about applying it towards art, you know, interesting endeavor. We've been talking a lot about the physics of it and the, you know, some of the unique properties of doing quantum computing. What are some of the applications in, you know, in a technical and a real world sense where mm-hmm. either it's being used or you think it's going to have really strong impact?
Historically speaking, the algorithm that I was just explaining, it was one of the first ones to be shown mathematically to have a dramatic speed up, so-called exponential speed up, where a quantum computer was doing something that really can't be done with a classical computer. It wasn't until Peter Shor came up with his what's now called Shor's factoring algorithm. His was the first algorithm that it wasn't the first algorithm to show mathematically that there would be a speed up in quantum computers, but it was the first algorithm where people could see a real world use case for that algorithm. And so where the earlier mathematically proven speedup algorithms did not excite people, this one really excited the world, the experts in the field. And it built this momentum, kickstarted this huge momentum to pursue real quantum computers. So today, where one of the places that people are seeing or pursuing the advantages of quantum computing are actually in systems that are related to physics simulations, where you can create a mapping between the quantum mechanics of some problem that some system you're trying to simulate, like what's the ground state of the electrons in a molecule, to map the quantum physics of that problem to essentially the quantum physics that's dictating how the computer works. And just as you can express any classical information with bits, you can express any quantum information with qubits. And so you can, the heart of your problem is trying to come up with efficient mathematical mapping of the quantum mechanics of your problem to expressing it with simple quantum logic gates occurring on quantum bits. So today people are excited if they're able to simulate small molecules with, you know, on the order of 10 atoms. That's actually very large already.
So this would be on you know, how the molecule is shaped based on the strength of the bonds and the interatomic forces and the interactions and that, and trying to predict what that's going to be.
I think what you would do is you would say we have certain background information, say for water, the molecule H2O. We understand what that the angle is. It's not a linear molecule. We know it has some kink to it. And we know approximately what that angle is between the nuclei, right? So we set some background, and then we say we also have an understanding of how many electrons are at play, right? And then we use the quantum computer to figure out what the ground state, or maybe the even more interestingly, the first few excited states of the electron configurations around those. And we say, we're going to, the electrons are able to move so much more quickly than the nuclei can, because they're so much lighter in mass than the nuclei, that we'll basically pretend the nuclei aren't moving. And we'll think about the electrons as the only things moving with the static nuclei.
And what would you do with that? So what would someone actually do with that kind of knowledge?
So if you can come up with what the ground state and the first few excited states of the electron configurations are on a molecule, you can deduce all sorts of chemical reactions with that that incorporate that molecule. And so you might have, say, a molecule that is even simpler than water in some sense, in the sense that it may only have two atoms, say lithium sulfide, right? And you are concerned about the behavior of this little molecule in some bulk, like a battery, where the ions are flowing and all the ions are essentially the same as each other. And you have to worry about how they bind to the anode or the cathode, right? So if you can understand how the electrons are configured around the simple molecule, you can deduce how it's going to behave in these environments that are what comprise extremely useful technology.
That helps to better sort of predict and optimize. For instance, if you needed to add other doping materials or other sort of trace elements into the battery to try and help improve aspects of the performance, for instance, mm-hmm. that could help you understand it. I mean, the usual one, if I think about simulating molecules, is around protein folding. But then generally, mm-hmm. if you're talking about a molecule of 10 atoms, that's much smaller than gets interesting for sort of protein folding, which is a very yeah. important problem for biological research.
Yes, exactly. And there have been some interesting research papers that try to come up with ways to hold certain parts of the molecule, these bigger molecules, the proteins, hold certain parts of the proteins still and focus on the dynamics of some small subpart of the protein so that you can fit the calculation on a quantum computer. And these approximations are similar in nature to what I was talking about with the water molecule, where we assume that the nuclei are so big and massive that they're basically standing still. Or we, for the protein, we might say, this is really the active region. We have evidence to believe this part of the protein is really active in the chemical process we're interested in. So let's assume the rest of it is essentially standing still, creating this background field in which everything else plays on.
I'd imagine you could also end up with sort of an iterative solution there where you assume the nuclei are static, and then you get a perspective of the forces from the electron states and positions, and then use that to potentially on a regular computer then move the atomic nuclei and then
yes.
repeat and iterate.
You actually, yeah, you got it. Indeed, there's this, based on this sort of approximation, that you can relegate some of the calculation to classical computer and focus a sub piece of the calculation on the quantum computer, indeed work iteratively from there.
So maybe just to bring it back to a little bit to a more tangible space. So
yeah,
how would I actually get started? So I understand there's the physics behind it is very interesting, but let's say I would like to try something. So I'm one of these artists, right? I'm assuming it's quite hard for an artist to get going. So is this that I open up on a Python script and I can write things? Do I log on to IBM's website and do I just start dragging and dropping gates together and hoping for the best, and then I push a little green button and life is good and poof, I get my result? Walk me through this on a practical level, Paul. How would I get started?
Yeah, you actually, I'd say you've sketched out the tool chain side of it pretty well. The user interface is, one of the user interfaces is dragging and dropping. We call that the circuit composer. And another user interface is, as you guessed, Python based. And with the students that we had at the new school, we actually were focusing on the Python approach. There's a tool that was designed specifically for visual artists in mind to help them create generative, digital generative works of art called Processor. And processing is now becoming Pythonic. All right, so we decided we would lean into that and have the artists who are sort of familiar with processing for other digital art reasons expand what they're doing in a Pythonic environment using what IBM shepherds an open source software development kit that's Pythonic called Qiskit. It's just Qiskit. And it's all like the user interfaces, the formal interface with Qiskit in Python. We have the IBM Quantum Lab, which is an easy way to use Python in the cloud, not have to install anything. And then there's the drag and drop. You're dragging and dropping quantum logic gates, which are analogous, kind of a generalization of the AND and OR and NAND gates you may have heard of from classical computing. But then there's knowing why you're doing what you're doing with these nice shiny user interfaces. And for understanding why you're doing something, my colleagues who focus on education, they've developed there's a piece of their website off of Qiskit.org that I think very cleverly asks you, how much time do you have to start learning quantum? A minute, a day, a week, a month, a year? And they'll filter down to the particular learning resources that they would recommend given the amount of time you want to dedicate to it. But the resource that I recommend the most is something that you can set your own pace with, which is like a digital online book that they wrote. These books also coming off of what these summer schools that my colleagues have been putting on. They've put on two week-long summer schools so far over the last two summers. And I believe that they have probably educated more students with these summer schools in quantum computing than all of the universities on Earth combined.
Wow.
They've had over 5,000 people take these courses, and they're free, open source. They were live. And then after they did some post-production, they put it up on YouTube, where the number of students who have used it has only grown exponentially. And each lecture, maybe every two lectures is a different expert from IBM who's focused on writing just these pair of lectures for you. And I think there's something like 20 lectures along in each summer school. And you can go at your own pace there too. So you can learn for free from some of the leading researchers on the cutting edge of the topic.
So it seems that quantum computing, it's got a big promise, but there has to be some limitations around this, right? So there's a physical device that is working somewhere, and you kind of called out qubits, and you keep calling out ones and twos, but you said, you know, for an image, this is a bit of a problem because maybe we don't have enough. So I would be curious to hear your thoughts on what are the limitations on the hardware, and two is there a single quantum computing machine architecture, or is that also very much defined on a physical layer of how you're capturing this? And it might not exactly be the same in every place on the planet based on gravity, I don't know, or vibrations or design. I have to believe there's a few gotchas around here.
Yeah. So today there are no fault tolerant quantum computers. And what we're aiming for are being able to control certain types of error. One of the simpler types of error to think about is you have to manipulate these quantum bits while they're in these unsharp superposition states. You don't want to perturb them too forcefully and have them pick a value, right? Like from the photon example. You don't want them to pick their value just yet while you're manipulating them to do the computation. You want to initialize your quantum bits so you know what you're working with at the start before you do any computation to them. So in the photon example, that'd be like, make you always send all your photons through a vertical filter. All right, so you know how they all start off. You force them to choose. Then you want to say entangle one photon to the other without making them go through any filters yet. And then you want them to, maybe that's your full computation. Your whole computation is initializing them and entangling them. And then you want to read them out. It's a pretty trivial result, but the essence of that is to say the entangling does not involve sending them through a filter. You want to do that at the end of your computation. Yeah. So the photon polarization is an example of a natural property that behaves like a quantum bit. The mathematics of the physics of polarization of photons works like the abstract math of a quantum bit. And when you're building a quantum computer, you want quantum bits that behave that way mathematically and physically, but are easy to manufacture and easy to control and easy to set up these dependencies between the quantum bits to do the entanglement and so on. And so the source of error and noise I was talking about is keeping them in unsharp states long enough to do the computation before they go through a process of what's called decohering. And then when they fully decohered, they've picked a value. They're actually zero or they're actually one, at which point they're behaving like classical bits.
So, and that's why it's at such low temperatures. So the low temperatures is because of that, right? So you're extending that decision process and you're controlling it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly true. So the types of quantum bits that IBM builds are called superconducting transmon qubits. And those types of qubits require extreme cold temperatures. These are temperatures about 15 millikelvin above absolute zero. Not all, but there's more than one way to build or engineer these controllable quantum bits to build quantum computers with. Another popular way to do it these days are so-called trapped ions, and those also require cooling. I believe the physics of those is very similar to how you create what are called Bose-Einstein condensates, laser cooling, right? So you bring them very, very cold temperatures. But I believe there are other ways. I think optical quantum computers do use this property of polarization of the photons, in which case you don't need them to be super cold, because that demonstration I was doing for the artists, I was doing it in room temperature with my light bulbs. But that's one source of error or noise that engineers have to deal with, is just keeping them quantum-y while you're doing the computation.
Do you think it'll get to the point that it is able to be done at regular temperatures and sizes, that it could actually be something that we have on our desk in our laptop, as opposed to at 15 millikelvin above absolute zero in a lab somewhere?
There is nothing there's no fundamental physics to preclude that. So in other words, I don't think there's any brick walls put up by nature for that engineers are going to hit their heads against. So eventually, yeah. But the way that we are going to engineer those and build those quantum bits will need to be radically different than the way we build them today. Actually, there are efforts to try to pursue what the next architecture is going to be. And some of those do not require extremely cold temperatures, but they've also not been realized yet in the real world.
So today, modern hardware architectures, right? Most of them have a CPU, and then you kind of iterate, well, maybe we need a CPU and a GPU. And then you say, well, maybe what we need is a specific hardware for machine learning or neural network, or and then you have maybe an FPGA for certain things. And then it kind of feels like a next level would be that you would just simply introduce another layer of a smaller quantum computing in that larger hardware architecture to do specific things. Is that
kind of... Yeah, actually, that's exactly right. You asked me a two-part question. I didn't get to the second part, which is related to this. You asked, are there limitations? And I started talking about the physical, like the error parts, but there's also the algorithmic limitations that, just like GPUs aren't better for all algorithms compared to a CPU, right? So like, it's not, when the GPU was invented, it will never replace the CPU, right? It's really good compared to a CPU for some things, but for other things, it's not economical to do the switch. The same thing is going to happen with quantum computers. The quantum computers will never fully replace classical computers. There's not a quantum speed up for all problems, only for a small number of quantum speed up algorithms are known today. And there's no reason to believe that, every classical algorithm will have a faster quantum version of it. There's no reason to believe that at all. So just like GPUs don't replace CPUs for everything, QPUs are not going to replace CPUs for everything either.
So this is also a limitation of how many qubits you can get in a system, because I understand that's one of the major kind of engineering and progress areas in the space is being able to get, you know, larger numbers of qubits that are able to work together and interact and entangle in order to solve progressively more complicated problems.
Yeah.
What's a typical number of qubits in some of the modern systems and in the current problems?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now, as we're speaking, IBM is working on delivering before the end of this year a 127 qubit chip. At the moment, their largest one is 65 qubits. And back in February of 2021, they published a research article showing that they had established a full entanglement of all 65 quantum bits. 65 qubits is about the limit of what you can simulate on today's most powerful classical supercomputers. So when IBM creates the 127 qubit chip, we'll be beyond what you can simulating a quantum computer with a supercomputer. However, there are the other characteristics related to noise and error, right, that limit the types of computations you can achieve, right? And so just having a lot of qubits doesn't guarantee industrial scale useful computations, right?
What do you think some of the first applications where quantum computing is going to have a really direct, like right now we're talking about art, we're talking about very particular research applications, we're talking about factoring, so quite a mathematical, quite an important area in abstract areas of math. Where do you think some of the first applications where we're going to see that in our day-to-day lives? And it's maybe not that we have a quantum computing module on our phone, but that we are getting some kind of service or something, maybe, you know, cloud-based quantum computing that's changing our day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that question. I tend to think of it, the big picture that I tend to think of is the way that it'll impact our everyday lives will be through the sorts of things that designers and engineers will be able to design through modeling. So an analogy is if you look at the types of bridges and buildings, you know, big architecture have been built in the last decade or so, and you compare it to a century ago or further back, right? There are shapes that you'd see in calculus class, vector calculus classes in modern architecture, really complex, varied surfaces. These are structures that would have been completely unmanageable to safely design and build before the advent of computer-aided design and architecture and civil engineering. Yeah. So by being able to computationally model these architectural systems, designers had created tools, you know, that allowed them to think in ways they just couldn't think before. They were able to expand the design space through the ability to model. And so I believe that quantum computing will unlock something very analogous, where you're going to be able to have designers and engineers modeling things that can only be modeled computationally with quantum computers, then designing and engineering things that could only have been realized through that expansion of their modeling capabilities. And in particular, the sorts of things that I don't hear a lot of people talk about it that way, about enabling modeling and engineering. But if I were to extrapolate what people are talking about, I would expect types of things that folks would be able to model and engineer would be biological in nature, and using quantum computers. It's not to say that biology is quantum and therefore quantum computers can do it better, but rather that there will be certain quantum algorithms that are amenable to simulating biological processes. That the math is somehow analogous.
Yeah, because quantum computing in some ways could solve, you know, one of the key challenges in generative design, which is exploring a very large solution space. Mm-hmm. That if I throw a problem at a computer for generative design, where I'm trying to make the computer, like give the computer the requirement and it just figures out how to build something in there. There's a very large number of possible solutions. So mm-hmm. I've seen examples of their designing, for instance, a motorcycle A arm, and then it, mm-hmm. you know, it sort of erodes away the material until you get this kind of spidery, you know, frame.
Skeletal.
Skeletal. I mean, aesthetically quite interesting, actually, but it perfectly fits the requirement, but the computing power and the iterations required to do that, and also to, frankly, manage that very large design space. Whereas if you're able to put that into quantum bits, which, like we talked about there, were earlier, you know, you're able to sort of run quantum parallel and get, you know, one or a small subset of answers, that could really allow, yeah, quite an incredibly powerful generative design engine. And then, as you say, I mean, that would unlock completely new directions for design and optimization.
Just out of curiosity, this is super interesting, but how on earth did you actually get started? So, you know, you sound like very knowledgeable in the space, but I'm assuming that when you were a teenager, you didn't say, I want to become a quantum computing expert. So how do you go from the passionate person about drawing as you were when you were a kid to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a great question. Oh, I had a really good physics teacher in high school. And I only remember her maiden name, Ms. Comito. She was getting married right about then, so I'd have a hard time finding her to say thank you. But I had a great, great physics teacher. She actually mentored me one-on-one after class, and because I had a lot of questions, and there wasn't enough time in the classroom for it. When I went off to school, I followed that interest. I was looking for people who explained quantum mechanics in an approachable way. And I'm still looking. I'm always looking. I'm always interested in like master explainers of these things. And it wasn't until many years, a few years after my PhD, that I found what I think is one of the greatest explainers of quantum mechanics, which is something that interested me before I even knew quantum computing was a thing. And that was Leonard Susskind, Susskind. And he wrote a series of really fantastic approachable little books, and they were based on a lecture series he did that an artist friend or I'm not sure if he was an artist, maybe a lay person, non-PhD person, asking him, you know, hey, we're buddies, but can you please explain it to me without, I'm not in your course though. And so what he came up with was a series of books called The Theoretical Minimum, which is like a kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke of something that physicists care about, you know, minimizing a function, right? But what he was thinking of was, what's the minimum amount of theory I need to teach you for you to really get it? And then if you go on and read something out in the real world, you'd get it. You'd have the minimum tool belts available to build more knowledge on. And he wrote a book specifically about quantum mechanics. And I read that after I got my PhD, and I learned a bunch of stuff. you know, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you really don't understand it. So keep learning more about it. And then I got into quantum computing in particular when I met Jay Gambetta, who runs the quantum computing division at IBM. I met him at a conference for physics, the APS March meeting. And he told me about this comparatively janky now website to let you program a real quantum computer for free. I almost couldn't believe what he was telling me. But I kicked the tires. And a few months later, they had a job opening for essentially a science communicator. And luckily, he remembered me and my experience of trying to communicate quantum to different audiences at my other jobs. They found sufficient to give me a shot.
So I think it's super interesting and inspiring the way that you're enabling people who traditionally wouldn't think of touching quantum computing to get their hands a little bit dirty. And I think it's really cool to kind of explore and open those gates, whether it is through Python or through the online drag and drop. And I very much appreciate that it's not an easy trajectory, but if you have some time, it is definitely possible. So how should people reach out to you? So if they want to learn more, where would they go? What would you recommend? And how would they reach out to you, Paul?
Oh, yeah. You can find me on LinkedIn. I try to respond to people as quickly as I can. It's just my full name. If you put it into LinkedIn, Paul Kassebaum. K-A-S-S-E-B-A-U-M. You'll probably find me as one of the top hits. Luckily, I've had the advantage of having jobs that have me make a lot of use of LinkedIn. So you'll probably find me on the top hit. And the buddies that I work with day in and day out who focus on education, they put a lot of love into the stuff they put on Qiskit.org and on Qiskit's YouTube channel. They're beautifully produced books, beautifully produced videos, and they're really trying to make it approachable for people who don't already have a PhD in quantum physics.
This is a great place to stop our conversation today. I wanted to thank you for listening to Tangible Computing. While we have your attention, we really want this podcast to trigger your curiosity and motivate you to engineer a better world. So let us know if you have any ideas for future topics or speakers or how to make this podcast better. Send an email to tangible@tangiblecomputing.com.